I think there are three things worth noticing at the start of this wonderful chapter. The first is this. You have in Isaiah 35 here a classical example of what is sometimes called the prophetic foreshortening of time. In other words, when the prophets in the Old Testament dreamed their dreams and saw their visions under God, they were not always as specific in their dates as to when these things would happen. You find a shortening of time, a compression and a condensing of time. And that's why it's sometimes difficult to separate the beginning from the end in some parts of the Old Testament, because the beginning and the end are so near each other, because in the prophecy the time sequence is condensed. You see this very particularly back in Isaiah chapter 5, which contains the famous Emmanuel prophecy. 1 minute Isaiah is speaking to King Ahaz, the weakling on the throne, and in the next minute he's speaking about God with us. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and shall bring forth a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. And in that one verse you rush from the 7th century BC to the coming of Christ. 1 minute he's speaking to Ahaz, and the next minute he's speaking about Emmanuel, God with us. There is a prophetic shortening of the time. You see the same thing in Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost, which we studied this morning. You remember that Peter starts by quoting the second chapter of Joel. The people around him are asking, what's the meaning of all this? How is it that these ignorant Galileans can preach the mighty works of God to us in our own native dialects? What's the meaning of all this? The flames of fire and men speaking in tongues. And Peter goes back to the Old Testament, to the book of Joel, and he says, this is that which was spoken of by the prophet Joel. And so he goes back to Joel, and the second chapter of Joel speaks about young men dreaming dreams, old men dreaming dreams, and seeing visions and prophesying the coming of the Spirit. And then suddenly, Peter rushes forward, as Joel does, to beyond that, to the end of the world. The sun will be darkened, and the moon will be turned to blood before the day of the Lord is manifest. And so Joel compresses time like an accordion. It's all there. All the history is there. But it's squeezed together. And so Peter rushes from the day of Pentecost and starts speaking about the end of the age, the shortening of time. And so the first thing to see is that that process is operating here in Isaiah chapter 35. The chapter starts with something that happens in this world. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, the desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom and rejoice. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. That's what happens in this world. But the chapter ends by speaking about something that's going to happen in the next world. In verse 10, the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, and everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. He starts off with something in this world, and he rushes forward to something that's going to happen in eternity, the ransomed of the Lord coming home to Zion. And that's a classical example of the prophetic shortening of time. The second thing that's worth noticing by way of introduction is that this is a chapter which starts and ends with joy and singing. In the first two verses, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, the desert shall rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. And in the last verse, the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness. And between the two joys and singings, in the middle of the chapter, you get all the blessings of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In verse 3, weak hands are made strong, and tottering knees are fortified. In verse 4, timid, fearful hearts are strengthened in a context of God coming to avenge his people. In verses 5 and 6, we find those who are blind seeing again, those who are deaf having their ears unstopped, cripples are leaping like deer, and the dumb are singing for joy. These are the blessings of the gospel of Christ. And in verse 8, a highway is raised in the desert, a holy way. It's the way home. It's the way home to God. And along that road walk the ransomed of the Lord, the redeemed of God. And all these blessings of the gospel and the blessings that come to men's lives with the coming of Christ are sandwiched between joy and singing. And I think that that alone makes this one of the most helpful and one of the most hopeful of all the passages in the Old Testament. Christian experience begins and ends with joy and singing. All the blessings of Christ are sandwiched between joy and singing. The third thing that one should notice by way of introduction is that in order to appreciate the wonder and the beauty and the force of this chapter and how it relates to Christ, you really need to set it against the previous chapter, which is chapter 34. And you have to juxtapose these two in order to get the flavor of 35. And if you do that, what you find is this: that the darkness of chapter 34 is there to heighten the light of chapter 35. Now, if you've ever read through Isaiah 34, you'll know it is, without any qualification, one of the darkest and one of the most horrific chapters in the Bible. The theme of 34 is the judgment of God. The judgment of God on Edom and its capital city of Bozrah. And this judgment of God is not an arbitrary thing. It's not a whimsical or a capricious thing on God's part. You may know that one book of the Old Testament, the book of Obadiah, is completely devoted to a study of the wrath of God on the nation of Edom, the nation that was descended from Esau. And various other passages in Isaiah and Jeremiah are found in which, once more, Edom is called to stand before God and answer for her deeds. And God gives a reason for his judgments on Edom. God is judging her for her heartlessness. It's for her callousness that God is against her. Her lack of fellow feeling and her lack of brotherly love. You may recall that when Israel was coming up from Egypt to enter the promised land, it was Edom that barred the way. It was Edom, Israel's brother, descended from Esau. It was Edom who put up the barriers and wouldn't let God's people get through. And later on in history, when Jerusalem was besieged by enemies and having a hard time and oppressed, it was the Edomites who waited at the crossroads for the evacuees and robbed them and raped them and looted them. And it was because of her lack of pity and her lovelessness that God brought Edom to judgment. If you look back to chapter 34, you will see something of the grimness of this. Chapter 34 and verse 5. For, and God is speaking, and in verse 5 he's a warrior, and moving through into verse 6 the image changes. He becomes a priest looking for a sacrifice to slaughter on the altar. In verse 5 he is the warrior. God says, my sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. Behold, it descends for judgment upon Edom, upon the people I have doomed. The Lord has a sword. It is sated with blood. It is gorged with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah, that's the capital, a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen shall fall with them, and young steers with the mighty bulls. Their land shall be soaked with blood, and their soil made rich with fat. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. God avenges his people. No one who touches a Christian gets past God unscathed. Whoever touches a Christian touches the apple of God's eye. The Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion, and the streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, and her soil into brimstone, her land shall become burning pitch. Night and day it shall not be quenched. Its smoke shall go up forever. You know that John the Apostle uses that verse in his imagery of hell in the book of Revelation. Night and day it shall not be quenched. Its smoke shall go up forever. From generation to generation, Edom shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever, but the hawk and the porcupine shall possess it. The owl and the raven shall dwell in it. He shall stretch the line of confusion over it, and the plummet of chaos over its nobles. They shall name it No Kingdom There, and all its princes shall be nothing. Thorns shall grow over its strongholds. nettles and thistles in its fortresses. It shall be the haunt of jackals and abode for ostriches, and wild beasts shall meet with the hyenas. The satyr shall cry to his fellow, yea, there shall the night hag alight and find for herself a resting place. There shall the owl nest and lay and hatch and gather her young in her shadow. Yea, there shall the kites be gathered, each one with her mate. And it's against all that horror and terror and blood and judgment that you must see chapter 35, with the desert blossoming for the church of God, and the blind seeing, and the deaf hearing, and so on, when Christ comes. One of the commentators says that chapter 34 is Dante's Inferno. It's a picture of hell. Chapter 35 is Dante's Paradiso. It's a picture of paradise. On the one hand, you get hell for those who have lived heartless, loveless lives, pitiless, callous, cold, hard, calculating. Hell for them. But for God's own, paradise in the coming of Christ. Now, having said these three words of introduction, the shortening of time and how Isaiah rushes right through the blessings of the gospel to the world to come, the ransomed of the Lord coming home to Zion, the shortening of time, the beginning and ending with singing and joy, and the paradise of chapter 35 seen against the heydays of chapter 34. What is the central message here of the coming Christ? I'm sure that this is a chapter which we ought to interpret symbolically. You know that there has always been a tension amongst Christians as to how to understand and interpret certain passages of the Bible. Should we approach these passages literally, or should we accept them as being symbolic? Should we be fundamentalists and accept absolutely everything just as it is written, literally? Or are there certain passages which have to be understood as symbolic? They are parabolic. They are metaphorical and allegorical. And that's how to understand them. Well, of course, there's nothing wrong with taking the Bible literally and verbatim and word for word. When the Bible speaks about human history, the history is never wrong when it tells us about certain kings and certain cities and certain battles and certain empires. The facts are true. The Bible cannot tell lies about factual history. But if you do that to all the Bible, then you're going to land in trouble. Because there are passages which have to be understood in a spiritual way. And you have to spiritualize the truth in order to get the contemporary sense. Just let me give you a good example of that. Way back in chapter 11, which we studied, with its picture of the renewed creation, and the wolf living with the lamb, and the leopard lying down with the kid, and the calf and the lion and the fatling lying down together, and so on. Do you take that literally, or do you understand it symbolically? Do you believe that there will actually be a day when wolves and lambs will live together, and leopards and kids will lie down together, and calves and lions and fatlings are all going to lie down together in the fields. Do you accept that literally? Or do you think it is symbolic? Well, there's nothing wrong with believing in the literal truth of that. And there are many fine Christians who accept that as a description of the new creation. The Bible tells us that God is going to make new heavens and new earth. And that chapter 11 of Isaiah could be a description of what a subdued creation will be like in a new earth. But you can also spiritualize these verses. When Christ comes to a man's heart and personality, the wolf lives with the lamb, and the leopard lies down with the kid, and the calf sits with the lion inside the man's personality. You see, Christ can subdue not simply creation. He can subdue human nature. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. In other words, when Christ comes to your heart, he comes to subdue your nature. And this is what Christ can do for sinners. He can bring an inner peace. He can bring a new regime in which the wolf in you and the lamb in you lie down together, because Christ has subdued you. And what's true for the person is also true for the church. It is collectively true. In the church of Christ, side by side in the pews, wolves are sitting beside lions, lambs and leopards are sitting beside kids, people with wild natures are sitting down in fellowship with more quiescent types. Excuse me, carnivores and vegetarians can sit side by side in the same pew. Wild people and gentle people. Because Christ has subdued them, and that's why they can have fellowship together. Creation is humbled and subdued when Jesus comes. That's chapter 11 of Isaiah. And in exactly the same way, we should spiritualize chapter 35. Now, you may recall that Jesus quoted this chapter in the course of his ministry when John the Baptist was in prison. He sent a message to Jesus asking if he was the Messiah. You see, John was an interesting character. He wasn't terribly sure of Christ. I have a feeling that John the Baptist found Christ's ministry a bit of a disappointment. Wasn't really what he expected. After all, John had been a very fiery man, like Elijah. In fact, Jesus said that John the Baptist was the second Elijah. Elijah was a spitfire. Why do you think he went to heaven in a blazing fiery chariot? His whole life summed up in a nutshell. Jesus was more like Elijah's successor, who was Elisha. He was a much quieter man. And I think John the Baptist was just a wee bit disappointment. You remember that Jesus said at that point, happy are they who are not offended because of me. Because John was a bit offended, you see. It wasn't quite the person he was waiting for. You find this in Matthew chapter 11, verse 1. When Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and preach in their cities. Matthew chapter 11, and we're now at the second verse. Now when John heard in prison of the deeds of the Christ, he sent words by his disciples and said to him, "Are you he who is to come? Or shall we look for another? This storm in a Galilean teacup, can this really be the Messiah coming?" Fancy starting your ministry in Galilee. It's like starting a world revival campaign in Ness. The end of Lewis, that's where the campaign is to be, to revive the world. Now it may well be that world revivals could start in Ness if the people started praying. But Jesus, you see, he didn't go to the capital start preaching. Billy Graham, you see, went to London and Glasgow, Edinburgh, all the big places, you see. You go to Madison Square Gardens in New York, or the Hollywood Bowl, the big places, you see. But to start your ministry in a cabbage patch in Galilee, John was disappointed. And Jesus answered them, "Go and tell John what you hear and see." Now here's Isaiah 35. "The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them. And blessed is he who takes no offense at me." See, John was offended. Jesus is quoting Isaiah 35 because the signs in Isaiah 35 are the messianic signs. Eyes seeing, ears hearing, cripples leaping. They weren't just magic tricks, as we said this morning. They weren't magic tricks performed by a wizard. Jesus wasn't a magician. They were signs that Christ had come. And that really is how to extract the goodness from Isaiah 35. You could put a heading at the top of this chapter: "The difference Jesus makes." You do believe that Jesus makes a difference, don't you? People often ask themselves the question, what is Jesus have to offer me? What does the gospel offer sinners? The difference Jesus makes. The first difference is that the deserts blossom. I'm speaking about the desert inside you. I'm speaking about the inner barrenness and the inner deadness inside you. Where there used to be sand and rocks and gravel inside your soul. Do you know what I'm speaking of? Spiritual wastes, arid, bleak hopelessness. When Jesus comes, what you see now is crocuses. Jesus comes to the desert, and it becomes fertile and fruitful. The same sort of imagery is found in verses 6 and 7. Waters, at the end of chapter, at verse 6, waters break forth in the wilderness. Now, the waters referred to here are not streams, but artesian wells, springs, deep, deep down, of living, natural, endless supplies of gushing water. Waters shall break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert of your heart. The burning sand of your heart shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground of your heart. Springs of water. That's one of the first tests as to whether Christ has come to your life or not. The desert begins to blossom. Now, is that true of you tonight? Is the wilderness inside you blossoming? Or are you just dead? Not only so, Isaiah says, strength and beauty come when Jesus comes. That strange reference at the end of verse 2 to the glory of Lebanon, which was the land of the cedars, and the majesty of Carmel, which was the land of the oaks, and to the vale of Sharon, which was the valley of flowers. When Jesus comes, strength and beauty come to the personality. Now, honestly, could you say that that is true of you tonight? I'm not speaking about religion or churchmanship or religiosity, or churchianity. That's not what I'm speaking about. These are the tests when Christ comes. This is the difference Christ makes. The desert blossoms, and strength and beauty come to a life. And not only so, in verses 5 onwards, people who once were blind now see. Those who used to be deaf, deaf to God, deaf to Christ, deaf to the Word, deaf to the Gospel, they hear. The cripple man in verse 6 begins to leap, and the dumb man starts to sing for joy. These are the tests of whether Christ has come or not, because these are the differences that Christ makes. Are you blind tonight? Or, having been blind, do you now see? Are you deaf tonight? Or, having once been deaf, can you now hear? Are you crippled tonight? Or, having once been a cripple, can you now leap for joy? Are you dumb tonight? Or, having once been dumb, have you now got something to sing about? I often think, you know, that one of the tests of real spirituality in a congregation is the quality of the praise. The singing in so many churches is absolutely dead, never gets off the ground. And the reason is not hard to seek. They have nothing to sing about. The tongue of the dumb shall sing. These are the differences that Christ makes. And there was one last test, and you'll find it referred to in verse 8 onwards. The Jews, you see, believed when they were in Babylon that there would be a high road through the desert from Babylon, and it would be a safe way. There would be no lions there or ravening beasts. There would be a safe way for God's people from Babylon to Jerusalem. In fact, that's how Handel's Messiah starts. Comfort ye my people. Prepare ye the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. There's a road from Babylon to Jerusalem. It's the only safe road. There's a road from this world to the next world. It's for the redeemed. It's for the ransomed of the Lord. It's for those who have been purchased by Christ. And it's got a name, this highway. It's called the Holy Way. And that's another test as to whether Christ has come or not. You see, it's a holy way for a holy people going to a holy place. And Isaiah says, people who are unclean and people who are fools won't be walking there. Holy way for a holy people, for a holy place. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean we should all go around with long, gloomy, sour faces. Although some Christians seem to think that the more miserable and grim you look, the holier you are. You don't find that idea in Scripture, you know. But then, of course, a lot of Christians haven't read Scripture. Holiness is simply separation. Separatedness, however you express it, whether you express it by the clothes you wear, or the pleasures you indulge in, or don't indulge in, or the company you keep or don't keep, or your habits or your manners or your tastes or even how you spend your holidays. Holiness can express itself in all sorts of ways, but it simply means separation. Here is the sum of the difference that Jesus makes. Those who once were blind now see. Those who once were deaf now hear. Those who once were cripples now walk. Those who once were dumb now sing. And all of them seeing, hearing, walking and singing are a holy people on a holy way going home to a holy God. Well, my friend, where do you stand in this matter of Christ coming to the heart and changing it? Where did you stand? Been coming to church all your life, been reading Bibles, saying prayers, and singing hymns all your life. Where do you stand tonight in this matter of Christ coming to make a difference to your life? These are the tests. Holy people
walking a holy road, home to a holy God. And when they reach him, this is what will happen in verse 10. The ransomed of the Lord shall return and come home to Zion. The singing, everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness. And sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Amen, and may the Lord add a blessing to his word.